This is side two of interview number seven for National Council of Jewish Women Oral History with Saul Weisberg.
I don't know whether it'll take an hour to talk about. Is it a side, a half hour?
A half hour.
I don't know whether it'll take an hour to talk about.
Well, whatever. We'll go on to something else.
But I will talk just a few minutes at least about that Yom Kippur War moment, if we can call it a moment. As you recall, of course, the Arabs in 1973, without warning, attacked Israel on Saturday, I guess it was, Yom Kippur. It so happens that Gerald Schroeck, the executive of the Federation, was away from Pittsburgh at the time in Spain, actually, or Portugal. And it was impossible to reach him for, I don't know what it was, 3 or 4 days. When I heard that Israel had been attacked, everyone, I became very disturbed and concerned. Gerald Ostro was chairman of the Federation campaign for that year, but and Don Robinson was president of the Federation at the time. I realized that action ought to be taken very quickly in connection with raising funds. Not that I was in any sense unique, along with other public relations activities and so forth. I called Don and asked if I could come see him to talk over what steps ought to be taken in response to this situation. Don was already taking steps, as you may be sure, knowing Don. But we agreed that I would come over that evening, and I went to visit him, just myself, and he was alone. And the two of us talked about the plans and the programs that we ought to get underway. And if my memory serves me right, we agreed at that time, particularly that there ought to be nearly two fundraising affairs. One, almost immediately, I don't know whether it was a Monday or a Tuesday, which would be limited to
installments, maybe.
Sorry about that.
Which would be limited to so-called very large givers. I don't remember whether it was $25,000 or $50,000 in those days. And a second fair, which would be not the general community, but would be 500 and over, or 1,000 over, whatever the case was. And immediately thereafter, we did put into effect invitations to this limited group of individuals, some of whom had been giving $100 or whatever it was, $1,000, and some of whom had not been giving to that extent, but who we felt, under the circumstances, would be willing to give, let's say, $50,000. And I think it was Monday, but I'm not sure. Maybe it was Tuesday. We did have an affair during the day to which I think there may have been about 30 people there. I believe, as a matter of fact, I can't remember now, but I think it was here and not the Concordia. I don't know why I remember that, but it seems to me it was here. And Don chaired it, not Jerry. Don chaired it as president of the Federation. And the attendance was very good. And the excitement was intense. The emotional response to the threat turned out to be obviously a very successful affair from the standpoint of fundraising, and also from the standpoint of individuals being tuned in, so to speak, to the whole emotional pitch of the occasion, of the circumstances, and so forth. People there, there's another name which I'll mention in a moment, people there, I think, almost hadn't realized how deeply they could be aroused when a really serious threat to Israel emerged. The same thing had happened, that is true, in the 1967 war, when people came pouring off the streets, and this is simply true, to make contributions at our switchboard. I think because of the surprise attack and the uncertainties in those first 2 or 3 days, the level of concern, the level of concern in 1973 may have been higher or greater than it was in 1967. Although I'm not sure about that. As I say those words, I remember now that 1967, the level of concern was extraordinary also. Anyway, the emotion was extraordinarily high. I don't mind putting in the record the fact that it was one of two occasions on which I've seen Don, who has always had a reputation as being under perfect control, publicly pretty much break down. I don't know if you've ever seen him. It's hard for us to imagine, because Don has a reputation of keeping his emotions in tight rein. But when he talked about this, and when he announced his own gift at this meeting, a small meeting and so forth, he, you know, he didn't sob, but he literally, obviously, he broke down emotionally. The other time, just as an aside, that I saw him, that happened to him, was when he accepted the presidency of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee in New York. I happened to be there. And whatever the reasons were, when he mentioned his family, while accepting the presidency and so forth, the same thing happened to him. It's interesting to see what circumstances, what subjects can suddenly touch valve inside the human being and cause it to open. But at this particular meeting, as I say, Don, when he announced his gift, I remember so vividly, and there they broke down. Others there also stayed in extraordinary excitement. Saul Spear was there, and so forth, obviously. In the meantime, we were all busy carrying on what might be called the normal activities, or the abnormal activities associated with this extremely abnormal occasion. Invitations were being rushed out like mad to the major fundraising affair, which was going to be at the Concordia Club. And there was a lot of public relations involved. Newspaper people were coming to the Federation and asking for comments about our reaction, the Federation's reaction to the 1973 war. I remember so well the television crew coming and interviewing Don. It's interesting to see how uneasy one can become when one is not really too accustomed to being in front of a television camera. I remember Don being quite uneasy. Conducted himself well. I'm not suggesting that he did, but I forget that was 12, 13 years ago, and of course, Don has had a lot more experience since then, even in the world scene. But the television crews were coming and asking for interviews, and we were issuing releases, and we were anyway, it was a very, very hectic that time. Jerry, if I remember right, he came back, came back before the Concordia meeting itself took place. It must have been within 5 or 6 days, I would think, of the date of the war. And the Concordia upstairs was filled. I think I'm trying to remember whether, you know, it's funny thing, I can't remember, but I think I'm trying to remember whether women were there.
The women were in another room. The men were upstairs. We were downstairs.
I was trying. Mm-hmm.
That's because you weren't with us, so you were upstairs.
I couldn't visualize. And the reason I couldn't visualize it was because if we were doing it today, the women would be there. And I'm saying to myself, is it possible that we excluded the women? But it's true. Of course, in those days, women were still conducting their own affairs. But then you, of course, remember the night that was an extraordinarily successful standpoint of money event. But on top of that, the emotional level was extraordinary. It was even keener, I think, than 1967. I don't know, Sylvia or Elmer, whether you would remember this or not, but probably the event I'm talking about, I'm sure, had only men. But in 1967, there was also, of course, a very high level of excitement, and there was a major event at Webster Hall, and Herb Friedman, who was then and today in some ways may still be the prime fundraiser, Herb Friedman came to Pittsburgh to address the group, and he really did do a remarkable performance of expressing on behalf of everybody there the feelings they had about the threat to Israel and the need for help and so forth. And it was an unusual affair. It was one of those affairs where, as in 1973, where the emotions were so thick that, as one might say, you could almost cut them with the knife. And in both instances, particularly in 73, I remember, I guess it was that way with the women too, people could hardly wait to announce their gifts and so forth. After that, of course, Jerry was back, and there's no point in continuing to talk about 73 war, right? It was over very quickly anyway, fortunately. And was successful from the standpoint of Israel's existence. It wasn't so successful in terms of the lives it cost and all the rest of it. But Pittsburgh did respond. I think in terms of demonstrating to at least those persons who were close to Federation and all, I think I could extend this to encompass perhaps almost the entire Jewish community. I can think of no other occasion in those 2 or 3 days of the Yom Kippur War where people, as I said much earlier, realized so clearly and so fully and so vividly what Israel really did mean to them, not intellectually, but emotionally. In that particular instance, the response to what had happened didn't pass through the mind at all, so to speak. It leaped directly from the heart. I've always been struck by that. Weren't you?
Well, it was an extraordinary time of drawing together, I think, of our community.
Yeah, anyway, it was quite an extraordinary... 1967 had a lot of that in it, too. Jews in this country, since the Holocaust, and maybe worthwhile talking about this somewhere on some of the Jews anyway, have had a continuing increase in their sense of Jewish consciousness. But there have been major leaps forward on a couple of occasions, certainly 1967 and certainly 1972, 73 were such leaps. Because they informed people about what Israel meant.
Well, among the other topics, Saul, that you had some time ago mentioned, you thought you would want to deal with, is there one that you would like to launch upon now?
Well, I've been thinking about, some of the items that were mentioned. I don't know whether I want to talk about the changes that I see in leadership or not. I'm not sure how illuminating useful my remarks will be. There have been big changes. Changes are not altogether leadership changes. They're changes which are rooted in major sociological, major economic, major societal, that major changes in the whole structure of our society and its outlook. I've been reading, or was reading for a while, I stopped, I have to go back to it, the book recently put out by Charles Silverman, that's certain people, have you been looking at it?
Yeah.
And I have some questions about some of his conclusions, I think. But I did think that he did do a pretty good job, in fact, a good job, one of the better jobs, of describing attitudes in the 30s and the 40s, both in the Jewish community and in the total community about Jews. There has been a tendency, I think, to come in part of a lot of people who forget really just how insecure the Jew felt back in the 30s and the 40s, and I think at least with what justice the Jew felt insecure. I'm older than both of you, and I remember the 30s very well because I was truly mature and I was very critical. And I remember very well that I'm sure you do to some extent, maybe fully, maybe as much as I do. But the concern, I think, largely justified that anti-Semitism could become really a prevalent way of thinking. Because anti-Semitism seemed to be very possibly an instrument of, in that matter, a part of the America First movement and the isolationist feelings in connection with the war. Issue number Lindbergh was part of that. Lindbergh was an isolationist and expressed, whether he was anti-Semitic or not, expressed what basically were anti-Jewish feelings. And there was a very close connection in the minds both of the Jews on the one hand captain of the so-called America Firsters. You know what I mean by America Firsters? That was the, the group who basically were opposed to any possible intervention in the war. They were opposed to Roosevelt's apparent thrust towards ever closer relationship to England, and therefore ever closer involvement in the war. And it did seem possible that inherent and almost essential, I'll pick back the word inherent, but almost essential to the success of the American First Movement would be finally to blame the Jews for any American involvement. And of course we can have the same kind of apparatus commonly that we have today, although there were defense agencies and such. What I've often wondered what would have happened if the Japanese had not dropped bombs, if the Japanese had merely, let us say, attacked Russia and omitted the United States. There was a lot of feeling in the United States against Russia at the time. It was quite possible that we might not have been involved. And I don't know what would have happened. Anyway, the Federation, biggest change in federations and, for that matter, communal life generally in this country, I think. By that I'm referring to such organizations as the American Jewish Committee and so forth, particularly federations. Communal structure has expanded since the war almost beyond, well, not believed exactly, but certainly beyond my expectations. I marvel at it sometimes, not so much at the amount of money which has become available to the communal structures and so forth, but rather just simply at the size of the administrative apparatus. I'm not being judgmental about this, but at least I'm trying not to be. I come from a different school, I think, in terms of attitude toward social work and social welfare and how one conducts business and so forth. The federations have become, in a sense, they're not so small, perhaps anymore, little corporations. And there's a certain corporate flavor to the way federations run things today that I find very interesting. Don't quote me on it, but I sometimes almost find it repugnant.
You're certainly entitled to your own opinions about it, Saul. I think that's valuable.
As I said, I'm not being judgmental in the sense that I'm not saying that this is bad. What I'm saying is that I find it difficult, or I would find it difficult, I think, but it's just different. There's tremendous efficiency, there's tremendous emphasis, and I should be the last one to make these comments because I was always complaining about the need for program audits, the need to review effectiveness and so forth. But there is a certain, at least in Pittsburgh, and it's true elsewhere too, it's true all over the country, there is an emphasis on order and on efficiency. And on growth and on expansion and so forth, which probably promotes tremendously, and I mean this sincerely, probably promotes tremendously the ability of the Jewish community to continue. Put it a little more succinctly, I didn't phrase that well. One of the, perhaps the prime purpose of Federation, after all, is today at least, it used to be at all. I don't want to make one of those speeches. But the prime purpose of Federation today is Jewish continuity. And the growth of the communal apparatus seems to me, at least, to be very important to this Jewish continuity. There are not a lot of people, I have a feeling, who are related to Judaism and Jewishness, because there is a large and an energetic and an effective federation. And I think these people, like, for that matter, the young business and professional women. And I think if it weren't for federation, these people very likely would have little or no connection with Judaism, and therefore with Jewish continuity. Therefore, as I say, I don't quarrel with this growth, and the growth in turn is dependent upon efficiency and upon order, I think. But I would find it hard, I think, to be comfortable in the long run with this, although maybe not. Maybe I would be happy, I don't know.
Do you think that Federation was not concerned with Jewish continuity until recently? I thought it always had been.
No.
No, it was not.
Federation, after all, you missed one of my speeches.
I'm sorry.
No. After all, Federation started in 1895 or 1896. I'm not going to give you a whole speech. But it did start in 1895 or 1896. The only thing Federation was in those days was an organization put together by a group of social direct action agencies who were competing for money. And they agreed they ought to put together a fundraising agency so they wouldn't compete with each other. And the only thing Federation was supposed to do was to raise money and then give it to these affiliated agencies. And up until the World War, that's all I would say that's all federations did, because they got involved to some extent in community relations and so forth. But at least the philosophical basis, the philosophical underpinning of federation was that it was a campaign organization that did budgeting. And planning, after all, to a large extent, was not part of not a Jewish fund, as it was called then. It was part of a federation of Jewish philanthropies, and it was not connected directly with fundraising inside the Jewish community that came out of the United Way. Anyway, the communal apparatus per se was not supposed to be involved in Jewish continuity. It was the synagogue that had that responsibility. If the Jewish community was going to live, it was going to live because of religious factors. But when the Holocaust took place, and the exile, I always said, were in gathered into Israel, and then Israel became established as a state, things began to change. Well, I'm going to finish this whether I'm on tape or not. Because, no, it's worth all saying. What happened was that the Federation, by circumstance, more than by wisdom, I think, became the tool and the instrument in this country of responding on behalf of American Jews to the Holocaust and to the ingathering of the exile and to Israel, the establishment of the State of Israel. So the elements which evoked intense emotional response. That is the Holocaust, the exiles, and Israel. Those elements, as I say, which evoke that sort of intense emotional response, were used by Federation and fundraising by Federation on behalf of those elements, on behalf of those programs, had tremendous meaning to the people who participated in the fundraising. The synagogues didn't seize on that. The synagogues weren't involved in any of that. Whether they should have been, whether they could have been, is a different question altogether. But the synagogues had nothing to do with what, in this country at least, except for a small minority of Jews, were really important. Synagogues were involved with the personal realities and problems of religious life.